Two Pints in a Corner is a music history podcast about the Channel Club in Boston, Mass. Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain are your hosts. They interview channel performers and workers, bringing out stories and memories of the great music and events that came through this iconic South Boston venue. Welcome to Two Pints in a Corner with Dinky Dawson and Tony Rain. Tony is still recovering, and so Sean McNally is doing the interviews with me, and he's doing an incredible job. And today we have Eric Bramford from Jazz in Hell. Welcome, Eric.
Thank you, Dickie. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, this is good. And Sean, are you there, sir?
I am, Dickie. Good to hear your voice as always. And hey, Eric, how are you, buddy?
Good. How you doing, Sean?
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you.
This is good.
Welcome.
This is good. I've got the first question. People don't know who Jazz in Hell is. And so what the deal is we're going to ask how you got this and when you started doing the music and when you got yourself in the channel, you know, that kind of thing. So we'll let you start with how did you name this Jazz in Hell, the music?
The explanation that I got from James, who was the singer who came up with the name, was that jazzin' is like an old-timey expression for screwing. So, even if you say it as screwing hell, I'm still not quite sure what it means, but he was adamant that that had to be the name of the band. So that's where it came from. Oh. I think it might have been inspired by the fact that I played sax, maybe. I don't know. But
your music was more of the new age style anyway, right?
It was sort of unclassifiable. I mean, people later said that we were the pioneers of Casio punk, because it was a little Casio keyboard. And if you remember, the drums were the little drums on the Casio.
Yeah, that's right.
And then I played sax and James sang, and that was a whole thing unto itself. And
that's Jazz in Hell for sure.
And we had a guy who had a bass that he made in metal shop out of a steel girder. And he also played soprano sax. So it was a weird instrumentation. I would just say, you know, if people want to hear what it sounded like, there's some stuff on YouTube that you could see. There's one video from the channel. I'm not sure which night it was, but it give you a little taste of what it was like. It was very, I guess, different from everything else, which is maybe why we did okay there. You know, I'm not sure.
Yeah, Sean went through it. I went through the times. You played seven times, according to Sean, and I believe that in 1986.
Yeah, six or seven times.
Well, you opened.
So it was.
You actually headlined. You were co-headlining a bunch of dates, but you did open for a couple of people that could be interesting. But let me just ask this. What happened? How did he get in the channel? Was it through Dave Mars, or was it from Warren or Brian Washburn?
So it's interesting, you know, we didn't really know about the channel system. And I think this is kind of an interesting topic, is the channel, you know, had this sort of tiered system, at least when we were there, of, you know, they had the new music review on Sunday, Monday. And then if you did okay at that, you kind of went to the all-star night in the midweek. And if you did okay at that, then they would put you opening for, national or local headlining bands. And this is all through Dave Mars, by the way. He was the only guy we really dealt with.
Oh, Dave Mars, yes.
Yeah. But this first day we went down there, it was a Sunday. And, I honestly, it was so long ago, I can't remember if I even sent a tape, but my recollection is that it was one of those things, like, if you had the balls to call up and show up and play, then you could play, you know, like, you just had to get put on the bill. And it was really a tryout thing. Sunday afternoon, you know, nobody's there except the people that you brought and the people the other bands brought. So we went down, we were all students at UVM. I lived in Essex, but I went to UVM. So I went out, picked everybody up in Vermont, came down, and we were we hadn't played hardly any shows. It was really like a dorm room project. We'd done some radio sessions because I was a DJ at the radio station up there. But we hadn't played much in front of people. So it was really, I had been to the channel when I was in high school. So I really wanted to play there. You know, it's like, you could pick one place that you could play in the world. Like that'd be great. If I could actually get someone to let me play there. And they said, okay, come play. So I went and picked them up in Vermont, came down in my mom's Chevette, you know, we broke down like half a mile from the club. We had all our stuff in the hatchback of the Chevette.
No.
Scooped it all out. This is how stupid we were, you know. Scooped it all out. We showed up, and you were there, and you said, well, where's your amps? And we said, oh, we thought you had amps. And yeah, so we had to run everything direct, you know. Like, you got a guitar and, you know, the bass and the Casio through that big, beautiful PA, you know, and the sax. And we did our thing, and then when it was over, you know, I thought, oh, God, you know, I saw Tony coming toward us. We're loading out the back. And I was like, oh, he's going to scream at me. Like, who did you fool to get in here? Whatever. But he said, oh, you guys are, you know, so different. It's so good to have something different in here. I'm going to have Dave call you, you know. And so Dave called me that day, the next day at my parents' house and said, we want you to come play the All-Star. But I didn't know what that was. Okay. You know, it's next Wednesday. It's literally 10 days later. So we played the All-Stars thing, and I think we played another one of those. And as this was going on, you know, we were sort of, you know, every time we would play, all the channel staff that weren't on that night would come in to see us. And we started sort of getting friendly with everybody, and they were all super supportive. And it was just such a great situation. And it was so, it meant so much to me that, you know, every single person was able to sort of look past the fact that we didn't sound like anything else. And it was, you know, there were definitely people there who hated us, you know, I mean, in terms of the crowd, but the staff all had enough of an open mind to listen to it and appreciate that it was different. And they were super supportive. And so, yeah, eventually we got to play a few Friday and Saturday nights. We played with the Straw Dogs in the Neighborhoods once, and Swinging Airdites in Lou Miami, and Rick Berlin another night. So yeah, it worked out well.
What was the experience playing an opening for Steel Pulse?
I think that might be a mistake, because unless the other guys played without me, which I doubt, because I'd always have to drive them down from Vermont, I don't think we opened for Steel Pulse, actually.
I've got you on the sheet. You were advertised in the Phoenix, because that's where I got it from.
Oh, I don't know. I know, you know, one other time we were booked to open for Hot Tuna, and that got pulled at the last minute because Hot Tuna was touring with somebody that they had to have open. Yeah. So it might have been one of those last minute switch up things or something. Mm-hmm. But no, we didn't open for Steel Pulse.
Well, okay, Sean, I've been yatting. I'll let you yat now, because you'll be having a good talk with Eric and see what's what here, you know?
Yeah, so I'm curious, Eric. So you guys got the gig at the channel, which was without a tape, which is pretty interesting. Did you guys have a tape out at that point, or not even have with that? You guys so early in the game didn't even have a tape yet.
Yeah, we had a tape because literally before we played in front of anybody, like I say, I was on the radio as a DJ, so I would bring us in and we would play on the radio. So we just taped that. But it didn't, I mean, it didn't sound, it was the same songs as we played live, but the live thing, if you remember, was very different than if you listen to a tape, you don't get any sense of what the live thing was like. I mean, James was just like this whirling dervish of a person. And so, yeah, we didn't. And like I say, I don't know if we sent a tape in or not, but you know, I think there were places like I know we got a show at Molly's around the same time without sending in a tape. And I think there were things like that, but it was, I think the Sunday afternoons was very much almost like an audition, like a tryout kind of thing.
Right. Exactly. And obviously, like you said, someone liked you enough to invite you back 10 days later, which is pretty good. But like you said, there was back then, we had that theories where for Sunday and Mondays, maybe like new music night. I think Tuesday was like metal night for a while, ska night. And then Wednesday was like the quote unquote all-star night, where the bands who, you know, either sold tickets or gave out tickets to their friends, I had a big draw, yeah, we'd get a chance invited back on a Wednesday or a Thursday. And then, you know, the idea was you want to try and get to become a Friday, Saturday act. You know, ideally as a headline, at worst case, you know, be on a nice bill where you're supporting some good bands where you're going to play in front of a lot more people, which is what happened with you guys. So, yeah, right. It's interesting. You guys only played, as I was talking earlier, it's like only 6 or 7 shows in the channel. It was all within like 5 or 6 months of 1986. So it was like kind of this like band out of nowhere just comes on the scene, college kids up in Vermont, and then the people in the club take a liking to you, and all of a sudden you're playing, you know, a half a dozen times in the next few months and opening for bands like Rick Berlin, the Movie, and New Man, and the Hoods, like you mentioned, who were all pretty much stalwart Boston headliners back then. So that must have been kind of a cool experience.
Yeah. It was, I mean, especially for me, because I was the only one from the area, you know, so I kind of knew what the channel was and what a big deal it was to play there. The other guys were from Vermont. They just knew it was like this amazing club that we went to every once in a while. But, yeah, like I was saying, like, you know, yesterday, just out of curiosity, I pointed an AI thing at the channel club, you know, your listing on bostonsbestliverock.com, just to get a sense of how many people had kind of climbed this ladder, and it spit out some numbers and stuff. And it actually said that we went from the audition to the Friday night faster than any band in the 13-year history of the channel. And we, you know, we weren't really bringing in a lot of people. It was all pretty much based on the support of, you know, Tony, Dinky, everybody in the security staff. I remember Carmelita was a big supporter. Everybody there. I mean, they were all so amazing, and they just like, we got to have you back. And,
one of the cool things about the channel, and we talk about this almost every episode, is how supportive and nourishing the local community, the Boston rock scene was back then. You know, we're talking mid-80s in this specific case, but you know, you mentioned Carmelita, like we had major radio stations with 50,000 watts, like WBCN, and you had COZ and AAF and all the college stations and FNX later on. And then, you know, a lot of those people on the air who were DJs were also coming to the channel and either emceeing or being a DJ at the club those nights. So you also get a chance to play in front of, you know, actual radio people when you played those shows. So Clearly, if you made an impression with any of them, like you did with the staff, they went back and they played you on the radio station or they talked about you on the radio, and then that goes nowhere but good.
Yeah, I remember Shred did one of the shows and he was really cool. I was just so amazed because to me it was just, oh, people are gonna hate this, you know, but I loved it. But I was like, you know, if you're listening to Extreme and stuff every night, that's probably what you're gonna like. You're not gonna like us. But everybody was super cool. I'd have these great, you know, like I remember Dinky, you told me about Half Man, Half Biscuit. Like we just have these good chats, and Tony would say, you know, come in. Like I remember he told me to come in on a Sunday to see Specimen. He's like, I think you'd really like Specimen. I know you never heard of him, but you really like him. So I took the train in, went to see him, hung around, talked to him the whole afternoon. It was a really cool show, you know, and just to have access and be able to talk to all these people with so much experience, so much knowledge, I had so much respect for it. It really meant the world to me. And I think everybody in our band, it was just a fantastic summer, you know.
For sure. And now you guys, so you mentioned you were at UVM, your local kid, but you went to UVM. Were you in other bands before Jazz and Hell, or was that really your first, you know, entry into the music business, so to speak?
Yeah, that was really my first real, I mean, I played in like a cover band in high school, but I hadn't really done a band. I'd never played in a club other than, you know, like with this cover band. And James had a band called Divot Head in high school. I mean, we were young. We were freshmen in college. So we were like 18, 19 years old. So we hadn't done a whole lot.
What was the music scene like in Vermont at that time?
There were some really good bands. And, you know, it was interesting. I can't remember who it was, if it was Dave or Tony or somebody, but sort of toward the end of that summer, I sort of threw out to one of them, like, you know, there are good bands in Vermont. We should have a Vermont night down here. And they said, yeah, do it, set it up. And they like gave me a Wednesday night or Tuesday night or something. Said, it's whoever you want to have down, we're going to do it. And I actually set it up, and then some of the other bands pulled out at the last minute. I think they didn't believe me or something, like they said it was real. But it kind of fell apart at the last minute. But, I mean, that was another case of, I mean, they were just being so supportive, and they I told them, like, these bands are great. And they're like, okay, we believe you. Let's do it. You know, and it was like, wow, that's incredible. But, yeah, there are good bands like the Hollywood Indians, Screaming Broccoli. I mean, Fish were playing out a lot. It wasn't really our thing. But, you know, The Switch, there's a bunch of really good bands up there.
Yeah, it was a great scene up there. We, you know, I was with, you know, Sam Black Church and a bunch of hardcore bands at that time. And we went up there every year, at least twice a year to Burlington. It was an awesome scene up there. You know, so many college kids. It was like the biggest city in the state. And right on Lake Champlain's right there. It was just a really beautiful downtown. And kids definitely came out for shows. I mean, back then there was, you know, the 242. Then right on, there was a Post. There was a couple of big halls. Memorial Hall, I think. Then, you know, Nectar's was the big hangout after that, where you get to go out and have those fries and gravy at 3 a.m. after you play the show. It was a really cool town. So I can imagine.
Yeah, no, but one of my best friends, Dennis Wigman's, ran Toast. That was a phenomenal club. And the Teen Center was great. We did a Fugazi show at the Teen Center in like 88 or something. And I mean, there were great shows there every weekend. I mean, yeah, there was a lot. There's a lot of outlets for that kind of stuff. So it really nurtured bands. You know, if you had something you could do musically, there were places for you to do it. So it was cool.
You said you also had your own radio show up there. How did you get into that? Did you have an interest in, you know, being a DJ at one point, or just helping promote bands, or how did you kind of find yourself in that world?
Yeah, not to be a DJ professionally, but I mean, I always listened to like ERS in high school. And that was the one thing I knew when I went to college. Like, that's one thing I know I want to do is be on the college radio station. So I did that sort of right off the bat. And I did, you know, different types of stuff. But I think that whole year, that year, 86, I did a show that was just Boston bands, because there was so much coming out of Boston. You could do that, you know, do right. 2 hours a week. Right. And it was called Sound of My Town. I know it sounds like a copy in Brett Milano, but it was actually before his book came out. So, that was great. It was, you know, like I was getting all the stuff from all the independent labels, Throbbing Lobster, Tang, whatever. And, you know, it really, I mean, I to this day, I'm just enamored of that era of Boston music. You know, I just love it.
Yeah, I think we always talk about this stuff, like the mid-80s or the 80s in general was really a really special time to be around the Boston music scene. And not that it's not special now, but just we've all talked about this before. You could play literally every night of the week back then if you wanted to. I mean, you could play literally the Rat, Bun Ratties, Jets. You could play the Channel. You could play the Paradise. I mean, you could literally play in town every night and go see shows every night if you wanted to. There were so many venues. The radio station, the support was amazing. And I think it's kind of cool, you know, you and I were talking before how you took a real, you know, being from Essex, you're local enough to Boston, but you were, you know, experiencing all these music, all these Boston acts, and to the point where you could actually have your entire radio show be dedicated to that. But you also kind of kept that with you. We were talking about how you really fell in with some of the bands that were kind of, you didn't want to see them go by the wayside. We talked about the Neats and Scruffy. Maybe talk about that a little bit and how you kind of got them, so they didn't kind of fall within the relics of time and get forgotten by people. How did you get involved with that stuff?
Yeah, so, you know, I just love all those bands from sort of the early mid-80s, Boston, Neat Scrub. I mean, I could go on for half an hour just listing off the bands, but one of the things that really bothered me later on was those records would go out of print, and I'd think to myself, like, I remember that Neat's album, Blues End Blue. I'd love to listen to that. I mean, I happen to have a copy, but if I wanted to tell a friend to listen to it, like, there's no way for them to do it. And I was like, that's crazy. So I started trying to think of albums I'd like to get re-released. And we actually did. I called Steve Fallon and ran Coyote Records, that put out those last two Neat records. And he just said, do whatever you want. It's fine with me. You know, so Eric Martin and I got together and we remastered all that stuff. And Carter Allen helped us source some stuff from BCN, like a really good 24-track recording from Newbury Sound that they did. It sounds incredible. Some other live stuff and some demos, and we put it out on Bandcamp, and you know, people really like that stuff. And then the Scruffy the Cat thing, I had a license deal with Sony. Like I called them up and they said, yeah, we'll license it to you if you want to put that stuff out, because I was completely unavailable. And they kind of, you know, when it got to the point of like where the master tapes, it started dragging out. I was getting really frustrated. And then Charlie Chesterman died. And I sent this really angry email to them. You know, we could have done this while he was around. His kids could have heard it, you know, all this. Like, sure. And it's, I was just angry, and that email got forwarded around, and eventually made it up to an EVP at Sony. And the day after I sent the email, I got a call from Sony. It's like, we're going to do whatever you want, whatever you want. Let's do it right now. We got to get this done right now. So I was like, oh, okay, well, you know. But then they called me a week later and said, you know, we're actually going to do it, which was fine with me because I didn't know what I was doing. I just wanted the stuff to get out. But they ended up finding all the master tapes, all the original artwork. Pete Weiss and there's a Boston guy named Tim Smith at Sony that remastered all that stuff and put it all out. And I mean, it's all digital. It's, you know, on streaming and Bandcamp and HD tracks if you want the high def. But sounds fantastic. That's all I really wanted to do, is make sure people could get access to it.
That's really awesome.
That's cool.
It's really awesome.
Yeah, very cool.
Great band. Like you said, there were so many bands you just saw on a daily basis, but we just took it for granted, you know. And then not everybody even recorded much of their stuff back then. But the bands that did, you know, like you say, it was very limited. You might put like their own 7-inch or something like that, or a local compilation. But to actually have the ability to go online now and hear some of that stuff is really fantastic. So that's a really cool thing you did.
I
thank you for doing that, because it's just great to have those bands that would have fallen by the wayside.
Exactly. Exactly, Sean. I like that a lot. Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah, I wish I could do more of it, but it's really time. I actually reached out to Chuck Warner. I was like, I want to put out the whole Throbbing Lobster catalog. And he said, go ahead. But, you know, and then I talked to some attorneys, and they're like, you're going to ask every single person who played on any of those records to sign it off. And it's like, forget it. Just forget it, you know. It's on YouTube.
That's the problem. It's so hard to reuse stuff like that people just do say, forget about it. It's not worth it. And it's kind of a shame, you know, because there's so many hoops to jump through and people to sign off.
Yeah.
And it's not like to be a million seller like that. You just want to have this stuff like saved and preserved, you know? So it's kind of a frustrating thing, right?
Yeah. It's, you know, like we definitely lost money on the Neats thing. I don't really care, because I like it accomplished what I wanted it to. But I mean, you know, there's kind of a middle ground, which is somebody's got a scratchy vinyl rip on YouTube. But, you know, if you really want to hear it, you could probably hear it for some of these records. But it's a lot of work, and it can be expensive, you know, too. I mean, even just to bake the tapes and remaster them and all that. So
you also mentioned a couple of shows that you almost got to play onto the channel with different circumstances came in the way and it fell apart. So give us a story about the Butthole Surfers, because I can tell you this, Dickie has a great story about the Butthole Surfers.
So I think it was like 87. They played, I know they played there a few times. I think this was 87. And we really wanted to get on that bill, you know. And I think we almost did, but then Chris Doherty had a thing called Iron Sausage, and they ended up doing it instead.
Yeah.
What we did was, James and I, the second the show was over, it was an amazing show, you know, second the show was over, we ran out to my car, got my sax out of the trunk, and we just bussed in the parking lot, you know, right near where people were coming out. Like, every single person that came out stopped to watch it. Like, you know, it's sold out. So, like, I mean, it's probably 1,200 people standing there watching us, and it's probably the most people we ever played to.
But, I get that.
You know?
That's
so a show. Bonus show. Now, Dinky, was that the show in 87 where Gibby threw out the back door?
I think it could have been it was the last show they ever played. It was before the... before the station thing happened and what have you.
Oh, right.
So
I think you have to tell this story, Eric. I don't know if you heard this before. There's a story. They were doing this show with the crazy, you know, back throwing lights and screens and, you know, x-ray the stuff on screen and whatnot. And then Gibby got a little carried away with the drum set. I'll let Dickie take this part of the story over, but it's pretty crazy.
Well, Gibby got carried away. He put lighter fluid on the cymbal, lit it, and hit it with a stick. So lighter fluid, flames were everywhere, all over the stage, all over the drums, all over people. I got hold of him and took him and his amplifier right out of that back door. I could not. I mean, he's bigger than me, but there's nobody going to, you know, set fire to the club because of stupid one dramatic art, you know. We have gore in there that was, you know, blood everywhere and this, that, and the other, you know, fake blood everywhere. These guys came and cleaned it up. They cleaned up the stage better than us lot. They took gaffer's tape off the damn drum riser. They did everything. That's how you do that kind of entertainment, that gory entertainment, but not set fire to damn stuff from a lighter fluid on the cymbal and just hit the cymbal so it, it goes, oh, we're real pretty, and then it sets fire to the stage or something, you know, or the people. But, you know, if they play the music the way they were playing it to them, very dramatic videos they got from Texas, you know, and from the university there. Yeah, it's sensational art form, but I've seen worse when I was in the 50s. I've seen far better than that with Screaming Lord Sutch and stuff. On stage, where he used to, where he used to stab his bass player and rip his guts out every night, every performance, doing Jack the Ripper. And what he got
sounds very Gore-ish for sure, just like Gore.
Well, this is 1957,
58. Yeah, that's outrageous.
Well, it's far beyond Rob Zombie and any of Gore and any of that stuff. He was just sensational, sort of, in working with the people. Working with the art, the people like you were on about, you give them some theatre, but at the same time, give them this great music. And I mean, when you have Jimmy Page in your band or Nicky Hopkins and all those people growing up, then you play some good music, you know, that kind of thing, you know. But you guys came and had a good time at the channel, and I always enjoyed it because it was so off the wall, the music that you played, and yet. So together, because it was a form of music that was just starting to hit everywhere around, you know, at that time, and a different kind of genre. We used to call it the shopping cart genre.
Well, yeah, I mean, I always, you know, and it's interesting, like, in the ensuing years, Dinky, I learned about your history and, you know, got your book and everything. Oh, my God, I had no idea back then. You know, people would sometimes say, oh, you know, he worked for the Mamas and the Papas and this, that, the other thing. But I was just so appreciative. Like, it was so obvious that you had sort of deep experience with music and the music world and everything. And it just meant, I mean, I remember, we would, after a couple of shows, we'd finish a show and I'd go running right back to the desk. I said, what do you think of that? You know? Kind of get your review. But, you know, I was telling Sean earlier, like, you gave me one of the best compliments. I'll never forget it. You know, after one of our shows, you said, you know, I've seen a lot of shows. I've never seen a show with this many people there. Not one person went to the bathroom. Not one person went and got a drink. Not one person turned to talk to their friend. They're staring at the stage the whole time. When anybody asked me, like, whether we are any good or not, I always quote that. I said, well, we might have not been good, but this guy said this about us. So that means something.
Well, you know, when that happens, it's actually gone back to the 60s and 70s with the people, because that's what used to happen on stage when people like us would come up on there in the 60s and 70s, is people would be shocked. They'd never heard anything like that or seen anything like that. But they knew it was real good in its own way. But, boy, that's different, completely different. And they wouldn't move. They would stand there, and then at the end of the night, they'd applaud like crazy, and they wouldn't let you off the damn stage. You know, it was that's what they used to do until 79 when the entertainment started. What I mean by that changed. The audience became the people that were all nuts. And the band weren't nuts. There were bands were trying to get through with the music, but they couldn't get through because the audience was doing its own thing, you know? Well, when you came, and when the 80s came, and when I came to the channel, I found out that anybody that came to that channel to see some of the local bands, to see some of the bigger bands, enjoyed it. They could get a drink and enjoy a quick chat, and then they'd shut up and listen to what's going on. And not only that, like you said, not go to the bathroom and stuff like that. So that's a special thing. And for that time period, in that era, you know, and I like that. Anyway. Yeah.
And just to be in front of people who could appreciate it, you know, because to me it was shocking that there were people like that out there, but it was just so encouraging, so meaningful to us.
That would be real encouraging all the time, because I felt that every time I had shows like that, you know. And sometimes we didn't have time to think about what was going on, and then all of a sudden you turn around and hear this song going off, and you see the people having a damn good time. and not being silly and not slam dancing all over the place and jumping off the stage and killing people. But
yeah, that was a great. That's a good point, Dick. It's a great compliment, Eric, that he gave you, because I can tell you, like as you just alluded to, we'd have 4, 5, 6 bands a night there every night.
Sometimes
in the weekend we'd have an all ages matinee show, then another show that night, like a reggae show or something, and then like you said, the Sunday new music shows, or sometimes all ages hardcore shows. So, you know, we literally saw thousands of bands, literally thousands of bands there. Yeah. So for Dickie to come out and tell you that, it really was a really tremendous compliment, honestly.
Yeah.
Not everybody got that kind of a exposure, you know, or compliment, I should say.
So. Yeah.
Well,
hey, tell me another fun story about you were a fan of the Dream Syndicate and wanted to go see them at the channel. Tell us about that story.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So, I've had some good times at the channel. It had nothing to do with playing there. Like, the Dream Syndicate were touring. They were one of my favorite bands. I don't know, it was like 87, maybe. They were touring and playing at the channel. It was 21 and over, and I'm 19, you know. So my friend and I drive down from Vermont. It's a 4-hour drive. No ticket, not old enough to get in. We find Steve Wynn in the parking lot. Told him, like, we just drove 5 hours. You kind of... okay, and he comes back out with 2 passes. He said, "You're the roadies. You're gonna be our roadies. You're gonna hump our stuff in, hump our stuff on." They're traveling with one guy at the time, so he was super happy. Like we're done in a minute, and you know, we went in their dressing room and just started getting loaded, and then the band came, and a couple of guys in the band got loaded with us, and we all kind of just went stumbling out to the stage, and you know. I mean, it was a fantastic time. The other time, I think I forgot to mention to you, Sean, is like there was a night when the Cramps played New Year's Eve. I think it was like 86.
Yeah,
87. And, you know, again, I'm not old enough to get it sold out. And I had a friend of mine, a girl, come in on the train from Hamilton. We're both too young to get in. And I'm either ballsy or stupid or both. But I was like, I think I can get us in. I think I can. These guys love me. So but as we're walking up, it's like, you know, it's not trivial to take the train on New Year's Eve from the North Shore. So as we're walking up, I'm thinking, oh, my God, this, you know, what if this goes wrong? I look like an idiot. But we walk up, first person there, Jasnell, you know, we're through. Second person taking the tickets, hey, Jasnell, we're through. Third person checking the IDs. I'm like, oh, no. Hey, Jasnell. So we get in, I get in, like 2 minutes after I get in, I see Tony, it's loud, you know, and he's like, he's looking at me, his eyes go wide, he's like, what are you doing here? Because he knows how old I am, you know.
Sure.
And I just kind of smile and shrug, and he puts his hands over his eyes, like, I didn't see you, I didn't see you.
I'm telling you to do that.
That was one of the best shows I ever saw in my life, that New Year's Eve, the Cramps, oh my God.
That was 86, 86, Sean, it was 86, DJ was Tommy Heidi.
Yeah, they were awesome. Cramps are so much fun. They talk about unique bands. They were so much
fun. Oh, so much fun.
Well, you must have made quite an impression on the girl you brought. That's awesome. Get it? You're both underage. You got into the Cramps sold out New Year's Eve show. Man, you must be the man.
I know. I felt like, oh my God, that actually worked.
That's cool. Well, after that, we have time thing, so we're gonna call this one. But that's been fun. I like that.
Thanks for good memories, Eric. I appreciate that.
Definitely,
yeah,
Eric.
Of course.
Definitely, Eric.
Thank you guys, and thanks again. Thanks, Dinky, for you know, that summer, and you know, we've kind of stayed in touch and on Facebook and stuff since then. It's just an honor and a pleasure to know you, you know, and Sean as well.
Well, we're just people. We just enjoy what we do, and it's good to hear someone who's enjoyed themselves at a place and in more ways than one.
And yeah, a lot of different ways.
And the channel was like that. It was fun all the way through, even though there were some rough nights. It was good though all the way through. All right, so here we go.
Way more positive than negative memories, that's for sure. Way more.
Yeah. All right.
I never had a bad time there.
So here we go. This is Two Pints in a Corner with Eric Bamford and with Sean McNally. We will be now closing out.